Mr. Yoshi. Hello. All the wahala, all the problems, all the things that you think that you must do to start in this world. Like when the teacher, schoolboy and schoolgirl come together. Who is the teacher? I go let you know. Who is the teacher? I go let you know. When we are children,
Papa, Mama, be teacher.
When we go to school,
teacher is a teacher.
In university,
professor is teacher.
When we start to work,
government is a teacher.
Who is the government's teacher?
Corruption and tradition.
Who is the government's teacher?
Corruption and tradition.
Corruption and tradition.
Our tradition is corruption.
Very good, you all pass.
Teacher, teacher, oh, God, it's a better be your name. Teacher, teacher, oh, and the lesson be the same. Don't ever teach me again, no.
The student who graduated yesterday, he died today.
The student who graduated yesterday, he died.
The student who graduated yesterday is dead.
Let us face ourselves in Africa. Now the matter of Africa, listen to this part of my song.
All the problems of this world we also carry in Africa. So what you running from?
I know run.
So what you running from?
I know run.
So what you running from?
Problems of inflation.
Which one?
Problems of corruption.
Which one?
Mismanagement.
Which one?
Stealing by government.
Which one?
Widespread disease.
Which one?
Brutality.
Which one?
Them all crazy.
Which one?
All over Africa.
Which one?
All over Africa.
Which one?
Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program, the African Sisters Media Network. And we are joined in the studio by Melanie Marshall, who is portraying Fela Kuti's mother in the Broadway musical Fela, which is coming to Oakland June 4th through 9th. Good morning, Melanie. How are you?
Morning. I'm very well. I hope you can hear me properly. I do apologize. I'm on a bus going to the Grand Canyon because I'm here in Las Vegas on my week off. So I'm traveling, traveling and talking to you at the same time.
Well, that sounds
great.
I'm glad.
Las Vegas.
Hello. And so, gosh, how was your tour been? I saw you in San Francisco and at Sumileyo, and you were wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a great role, and I have a wonderful time performing it. I don't even look upon it as work because it's just a joy to go out there and perform and to portray such a strong, powerful, feminist, activist woman who really instilled in her son all of her doctrines about the politics of Nigeria and speaking up for the people who didn't really have a voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people might be surprised at how close Fela was to his mother. He consults her on all of his big decisions, and the relationship
every
is just so wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and in the show is taken up after her death. There was a raid on Calicutta, which is where Fela lived, his family, his queens, his area boys, his musicians, everybody. And that was raided in 1977, and his mother was thrown from a two-story window by the soldiers, and she took 3 weeks to die from her injuries. That's part of the show, because obviously that's part of Fela's history. And so as a ghost, as a spirit, as it were, being in the show, I am there as Fela's voice of reason. I'm that little voice in his head. I'm that little tap on his shoulder, just letting him know that A, I am there, B, I am with him, and C, I am watching over him and making sure that he is still making the right decisions.
Mhm. Yeah, yeah. Tell us a little bit about the give us the context of Fela's you know, just maybe tell us a little bit about him and you know, his family before, you know, he came to America and met the woman who was going to Sandra Isidore, who was the woman who was maybe give us a little bit of the story and the context.
Yes. Well, Fela was probably one of the greatest musicians to ever come out of Nigeria. Singer, songwriter, political activist, voice for, like I said, the people who didn't have a voice. His mother was a great feminist and great political activist in her own right. First woman to drive a car, first woman to visit China, on first name terms with all of the African leaders. And in that, she tried to make sure that Fela was going to continue her legacy, as it were. And so, therefore, as much as he loved music, as much as he was trained in classical music by his father, his uncle, and other teachers, when he decided that he wanted to leave Nigeria to go and study, he told his mother that he was going to study medicine. And in fact, he had no intention of doing that, and he went to study at Trinity College of Music, which was, I suppose, a rival college of mine. I'm from London myself. And studying music, it then enabled him to create his brand of music, which is known as Afrobeat. And the only way to describe Afrobeat would be a huge melting pot of wonderful seasonings, vegetables, meat, tastes from all around the world, all of the different genres of music that he heard and he listened to and was influenced by, Frank Sinatra and especially James Brown. When you hear any of Fela's music, you'll hear that driving drum beat and you'll also hear the driving horn section. And that is his signature. And also, if you listen to a lot of music today, if you listen to a lot of the rappers, it's quite amazing how, for example, a friend of mine called Mike Ellison, who does a great educational program for school children in this country, especially in Detroit, and he goes around and he talks about Afrobeat and Fela and his influence on music, and he played Fela's music and he played a bit of Tupac's music and he played a bit of James Brown's music, and you know something, it's quite difficult to tell which is which or who wrote it first. You know, that's how distinctive his music is and how influential it is to people today. It's like anything else, I suppose. You know, Bach and Purcell and Handel and all of those great composers. You know, you can always see a little bit of something in everybody's music. But Fela traveled the world. Yes, he traveled the world, and he could have been a millionaire. He could have been a millionaire 10 times over. And he could have been as popular as, for example, Stevie Wonder or the Beatles. But he decided, through his mother's influence again, that yes, it was okay to travel the world. It was okay to come to Los Angeles, for example, where he did meet Sandra Isidore. And she was the one who said, listen, I understand about your politics in Nigeria, in Africa, but here in the States, look at the politicians here. Look at Malcolm X. Look at Martin Luther King. Look at all of these black, historical, powerful leaders who are speaking up for the black community here. And, you know, it's a bit like suck it and see. His mother had been telling him about all of these people before. But he had to leave to L.A., meet Sandra Isidore in a nightclub, for her to influence him, for him to realize and say, actually, yes, I've heard about all of these people before, but I suppose I just needed to be here. I needed to soak up all of that information from a different source, from a different, you know, to actually be here in the country. And so it's quite interesting how his political views broadened after he came to the States. And so he was able to go back to Nigeria and realizing that perhaps, you know, black politics weren't that different, but it just had a different spin in the States. And so he was able to go back garnered with that information and speak up for the people. Philip was a non-violent man, and so therefore his mantra was and still is, music is the weapon. And he uses music, he uses his lyrics especially to tell and to complain and to just rail against the Nigerian government. And all of his songs are really relevant today. When we first started the tour in 2011, it was all about Occupy, and then it would be, you know, whichever city or whichever state we were in. And so on tour, we would go to, for example, Toronto, Washington, San Francisco, all of these beautiful, beautiful places, and we'd see tents set up, and there'd be, you know, all these placards, the rich against the poor, and talking about the government. And Fela wrote, for example, this is a song called ITT, International Thief, or as he would say, International Thief. And he wrote that back in the 70s. And just think, 2011, all those years, fast forwarding, and it's still relevant today.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you are, you said you're from Europe, from England?
Yes.
Yeah, and
yes.
Your training is at the Royal College of Music.
I trained at the Royal College of Music. I studied singing and piano.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Because one wonderful aspect of the program is that the music is just so phenomenal. There are live musicians on stage. I mean, lots of them.
It's wonderful. And before 2010, May of 2010, I had never heard of Fela Kuti. And
really?
I've never heard of him. A friend of mine went to see the show on Broadway. A fellow Brit went to see the show on Broadway and rang me and said, Melanie, I've just seen your next job. Check it out on YouTube. And he put the phone down. I thought, oh, gosh, now what did he say? Did he say Othello? And I looked that up and it wasn't that. And then I looked up Fellow, perhaps it was F-E-L-L-O-W, and it wasn't that. Eventually I got around to Fella, exclamation mark. And all I saw was the first 5 minutes, and I was completely hooked. I knew that I had to be part of that production. And so therefore it was the show to audition for in London. So whilst it was on Broadway, we did a production in London, 2010. November 2010, and we finished on January the 19th, 2011. And from the brilliance of the Broadway cast and the British cast, the producers, American Equity, British Equity, then decided that we should amalgamate. And so the special few that were picked and chosen. We started off in Amsterdam in May 2011 for 6 weeks for the Holland Festival, which was wonderful. Then we went back to a different theatre in London in September. And then from October of 2011, we toured States and Canada. And we ended up on Broadway again. So I can say that I made my Broadway debut. I was very, very proud of that. That was in July of last year, just for 4 weeks, but it was wonderful. And so we started the tour up again with a few new members of the cast this time, but I'm the only British person that they brought back, the only European person that they brought back. So I'm very proud to carry the mantra of Fumilayo one more time.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So when you saw the Fela on YouTube and said, okay, I'm going to be in this show, like your friend told you.
Yes.
Did you audition for Fumilayo?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay. Oh.
This was oh yes, this was the show to audition for. This wasn't a matter of just because I said I was going to be in it, I was going to be in it. Oh no, no, no. I had to go through the process just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And what was amazing, usually in an audition, especially for a musical, when you go to the audition, you hear, you just have a pianist who plays for you. I had a pianist, a drummer,
mm-hmm.
a double bass, and a guitar. And so immediately you get the feel of Afrobeat. You get the feel of Afrobeat, and it was amazing. You couldn't help but want to be. So therefore, you know, you were totally enveloped by that whole melting pot of marvelousness. That's what I call it, melting pot of marvelousness, because the beat will get you every single time. You cannot sit still when you hear fellas' music, even when it's a sad song. You can't help but tap your feet, or especially listen to the lyrics. The lyrics are very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that driving beat with the drums and the horn section that just makes it instantly likable. Yes.
Yeah, I was noticing that you were nominated for a 2012 Helen Hayes Award for Best Lead Actress in a Non-Residential Production for your role in Vela.
Yes, I was very, very proud of that. Mm-hmm. Very, very proud of that indeed. And I went along to the ceremony, and I lost out to Kate Blanchett. So I thought, well, it can't be that bad. I thought, that's all right. That's all right then. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But no, just an honor to be, you know, to be recognized, especially in this, you know, in a foreign country. I take my job very, very seriously, and I try sometimes to give 110%. Sometimes I can only give 100%. But you know, just generally, I'm very proud of when I step on that stage and I make sure that I conduct myself and I give Fomalhaut the respect and the dignity that she deserves. When I meet people from Nigeria and they speak of her, I get this feeling of awe. I get this feeling of reverence still, even though she's been dead. And to walk on stage with that, not burden, but to walk on stage with that whole aura of brilliance, of strength, of dignity, of reverence, and esteem, it really does do something to you as a performer. That's why I said at the very beginning that I don't regard it as a job. I regard it as an absolute pleasure, and wonderful to perform. The wonderful Bill T. Jones, who directed and choreographed and co-wrote this show, was very generous in that, you know, a lot of directors, especially when a show has been up and running, he could have easily have turned around and said, well, listen, this is how the role of Fomalhaut has been done since workshops in 2006, and this is the way you will sing it, word for word for word, note for note. And the only thing that I do exactly the same are the movements on stage and the costume that I wear. Other than that, he has allowed me to bring my classical, jazz, stroke, gospel style to the music. I sing it completely different to the other Fomalhauts who have gone before me. The first being the brilliant Lilias White, and secondly, Patti LaBelle. And so, from the three of us, we've brought completely different stands to the role and a different style. And I love it. I absolutely love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of your you know, theater credits include Hot Mikado at the Watermill Theater, Simply Heavenly, Young Vic, and Trafalgar Studios, The Fat Lady Sings,
yeah.
Elsa Canasta,
yeah.
Is it La Evil with the Rampart Dance Company?
Levi. Yes, with the Ron Baird Dance Company, yes.
Yeah, Carmen Jones, Porgy and Bess,
yes.
Fame, Amos
yes.
B. Haven,
yes.
Kiss Me Kate, all at West End. Your television and film credits include Alice in Wonderland, The Wide Sargasso Sea,
yes.
Ray, Songs of Praise, The Walker, and Casualty. And then you've got
yes.
recordings, Feel the Spirit, A Christmas
yes.
Festival, Messiah, Distant Land, all conducted by John Rutter.
Yes.
And Cocktail, and then you have BBC Radio credits include Friday Night is Music Night, In Tune, and Stephen Sondheim's 75th birthday concert.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, and you performed, appeared with the Royal Philharmonic, Liverpool, The Hale, and all the BBC orchestras, and you
the
performed
Holly,
in yes. concert at Carnegie Hall. And all major
yes.
UK concert venues, you are famous.
I'm lucky,
you know,
that,
lucky
I keep,
you have time in your schedule to be able to fit in, fella.
One thing I keep forgetting, or should I say that I've omitted, especially being in this country, if you watch the royal wedding of Charles and Di back in 1981,
uh-huh.
and you fast forward an hour, I think it's an hour and 18 minutes, just after Kira Takanawa has sung
mm-hmm.
Let the Bright Seraphim. I'm in the Bach choir that then sings straight after the chorus that follows that aria. And in the first 10 seconds, the camera is right on my little face. I'm the only black face on there in the Bach choir. So that was quite an honor in 1981. You know, you forget that everything that was ever on television is now on YouTube. Yes, I've had a varied career, and I would not change or exchange it for anything else. I have a brother who's also a musician, Wayne, who's a pianist, an organist and conductor. I've got my younger sister, Louise, who's a singer, songwriter, pianist, music arranger. So all three of us are in the music business somehow, somewhere, but I'm the only one who's really pursued the acting side. But it's just nice to, you know, to do something different, but, you know, and when we can all get together, it's wonderful, but it's lovely to travel. It's certainly lovely being in this country, and I can't wait to come back to San Francisco again. Can't mm-hmm. wait.
Yeah. Well, you'll be in Oakland across the bay, so it'll be a little bit different.
Well, it would be nice to nip over and see, but mm-hmm. when I was in San Francisco last time, mm-hmm. I nipped over to Oakland. So it'd be nice, to revisit, but obviously revisit for a bit longer this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which
yeah.
is really nice. Yeah, and when you all were here in San Francisco last, I had an opportunity to speak to Adesola Osa.
Adesola, yes.
Yeah, yeah, and he's now
yeah.
the lead.
He is now the lead, and a well-deserved lead as well. He is absolutely fantastic, absolutely fantastic. He brings that swagger and that anger that Stella had. And for those of you who haven't seen the show, he never leaves the stage for about 5 minutes. For the entire time, he is on that stage. It's a very physical role. It's a very demanding role, as was Fella. And, you know, that energy is never let up at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very spiritual show. It's a very entertaining show. It's a very amusing show, musical. And, you know, we try and portray in the 2.5 hours, 58 years of somebody's life. And his influences and his music and his mother and family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd like to think that we do a great job. Audiences all over have loved the show, and I can't wait to come and finish the tour, actually, in Oakland
mm-hmm.
this time. And it's going to be a little bit sad, but you know, we'll finish on a high, and we'll finish in Oakland this year.
Oh, wow, that's so wonderful. Yeah, I when I was speaking to members of the cast last time, they were telling me that you were able to go to the shrine and perform in Nigeria.
Oh, that was the American cast. That was a British cast. I'm still waiting for that opportunity.
Okay.
So it was promised to the Broadway cast when they finished in January that if they could, if it was possible, yes, they would take the show to Lagos, and they went in March of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
They went there for 3 weeks, and yes, they performed in the shrine. And at first, you know, from what I gather, what they were telling me, they were saying that, you know, it's a bit like bringing, as we would say in England, it's a bit like bringing coals to Newcastle or perhaps sand to Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
Whereby, you know, you're taking their story and performing it for them. You're giving an American twist, as it were, on this very famous Nigerian story. And how was that, you know, how was that going to pan out? You know, how would that work? But, you know, they welcomed the show and the actors and the dancers and the singers and the band with open arms, because the show is very, very authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And having been to the show now since 2010, what I said to the new cast, especially, don't forget that you are always performing a great legacy. These are not just characters that we're performing. These are not just little sets that somebody's put together, you know, like in Carousel or Oklahoma or Porgy and Bess. This, we are portraying a real story about real life people who went through a lot. And so carry that thought with you when you step on that stage. In fact, carry that thought with you when you come to the stage door and leave everything else that's in your life at the moment. You leave that outside. Leave that outside and come with Fella 110% every single show. And I'd like to think that that is exactly what we do. It's a tough show. It's a hard show. And afterwards, you know, especially for the dancers, it's as if they've done Zumba. What's that guy who does the that really ridiculous fitness thing? Sean T. What's that? Do you know the one I mean?
No, I don't.
Oh dear. Anyway, that real fitness guru workout. It's all of it, plus singing, plus dancing. But it's a joy. It's an absolute joy. So, Oakland, be ready. Please come out. Please come and see us. I'm not even sure what theater is that. You'll be able to
the Paramount Theater.
Tell me that door. There you go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we're there from June the 4th until the 9th. Please come out. Please come and support us and help us to finish off this tour with a bang.
Mhm. Yeah. Do you have a favorite song of the repertoire? And I just want to mention that one of my favorite scenes is when the ancestors come out, and
that is
just so beautiful. And people always comment in some of the audience talkbacks how it's not acting. This is like the real deal. It feels, you know, like the spirit is really there, like the Orisha are really with us in the theater.
Yes. Well, that's the only song the song you're referring to is Rain, the aria that I do call it an aria because it really is an aria that I sing. And it's the only song that is not written by Fella. The first four lines that I sing are written by Fella, and then after that, Jordan McLean and Aaron Johnson, who is the leader and the musical director of Antibala, probably one of the greatest American groups to perform Fella's music as authentically as it can possibly be. And they're the ones who are on stage. Well, at least a lot of the members of Antibala are on stage performing in the show. And the significance of the song Rain, When Fumilayo's body was taken to the steps of the government by Fella and his followers, it began to rain. And it rained for such a long time. So therefore, the significance is whenever Salah thinks about his mother or feels that his mother is talking to him,
You're breaking up a little bit. Melanie? Uh-oh. Well, I just want to mention that we're speaking to Melanie Marshall, and she and the other cast are coming to town for encore production of Fela, the musical. And for discount tickets, you can call area code 1-800-745-3000 and mention the code AFROS, AFROS, as in Afro Solo. And Afro Solo will get 10% of the ticket price, and tickets are $37.50, I believe, with the discount. So support Afro Solo by when you mention Afros, you get the discount. So again, Fela's going to be in Oakland, California, from June 4th through 9th. It's going to be really exciting. So we are joined in the studio by one of our favorite guests. Good morning, Ann. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. How are you? Fine, thank you.
Hi. Oh, it's so perfect that you be joining us now to talk about you know, your organization is taking the ancestor honoring next, you know, sort of be following with a talk about Fela Kuti, you know,
right.
And his mother in this particular, I guess presentation of his life. Did you see it?
No, I haven't seen it, but Fela was always one of my favorite artists. I really, you know, have admired him and his political stance and use of his music to express his position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that, you know, that he ran for president and his whole thing around the black president, and we have a black president in America now.
That's true.
Yeah.
So yeah. We're almost coming full circle, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's hard to tell sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Middle Passage Ceremonies and Port Markers Project, you have a ceremony on Monday, the
27th.
Yeah, yeah.
We are
so,
very
excited.
So where
are you going to be going this time? Mm-hmm.
Well, this one will be Yorktown, Virginia. It's a little town with a lot of history.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the focus has been traditionally on its role in the Revolutionary War and also in the Civil War. So it's a battlefield, and it's the place where Cornwallis, if you know your American colonial history, the place where Cornwallis surrendered. Well, long before that, it was the major port city where Africans arrived. And I'm always kind of blown away by the statistic that's been supported by research, that more than 31,500 Africans arrived in the York River District in about 80 years, in the span of 80 years. And I would say, you know, that's 31,000 people showing up not in New York City, but in a complete wilderness. So Yorktown was the port city after Jamestown basically closed down, and the capital of the Virginia colony was moved to Williamsburg, which is landlocked. Yorktown became the port for the capital. This is only one of the three major rivers in Virginia. So you have the James River, which we will do Jamestown in August. Actually, August 23rd, and Fredericksburg, Virginia, which until this year, they thought they were only part of what we call the domestic trade, which was the internal trade of moving people basically out of Virginia into the frontiers. But Yorktown is the first primary port for Virginia, more so than Jamestown.
Wow.
So the other part of what's going to happen, because we've already had ceremonies in Maryland and completed those three ports, but we did not we've not put up markers yet. In Yorktown on Monday will be the first Middle Passage port marker ever placed in the United States.
Oh.
So, I mean, it's a big deal, you know, for us, certainly. And I think, you know, for the project and for African Americans, anyone who traces their history back to Virginia, it's a good chance that they, like my family, arrived at Yorktown.
Oh, so this is just your point of entry, your ancestors.
I am pretty sure, based on what we've been able to pull up, and it was, you know, I started visiting Yorktown 2 years ago to begin the conversation with city officials and the Park Service about having a ceremony and placing a marker. Because if you go, like I said, to most of these colonial places, you know, they will talk about very specific and narrow points of history. And we're, as Africans and their descendants, very often completely left out of that story. So what we're doing in all of these port cities is saying that, you know, we don't call them British or French or Spanish or Portuguese settlements. We call them European African settlements, because Africans came with the Europeans. I mean, there would not have been the settlements, there would not have been the economic growth or the actual development of any of these colonies without the presence of African people and their influence upon the culture and the whole structure, the economy. So we're very excited to have this marker put up. And it would put it right at the base of what they call the valley, which is where the Africans were unloaded off the ships and they walked up the valley to the market.
Right in the footsteps, huh?
Right in the footsteps. And that's what we're doing at the end of the program, is for people who want to, they can walk the valley so that they can walk in the footsteps of the ancestors.
So what is the marker? What does it look like?
Well, it has Remembering Ancestors. The Park Service, National Park Service is actually has assumed the cost for this, which is amazing. Park Service has been very aggressive and active in recording and documenting African-American history. So it is a 30 by 60-inch marker. My husband says it's almost like a billboard. And you know, it's huge. It's huge. Mm-hmm. And on the left side, in the left half, it talks about the 2 million who died in the Atlantic crossing, the 12 million who had left Africa, the 10 million who arrived in the Western Hemisphere. And the influence that they had upon the economic development of the Western Hemisphere. And on the right side is very specific, addressed to Yorktown. Mm-hmm. So that what we're hoping is that, at least in Virginia, the left side will be general, the right side will be specific to the locale to talk about that history. And then the map of the colonial area of Virginia, so that you see the James River, the York River, and the Rappahannock, because those are the three major rivers. And so that all is there on the marker.
Well, that's excellent. So, because in your announcement, you mentioned that we are formally honoring and remembering more than 31,000 500 Africans who arrived in the York River District between 1698 and 1771, and the contributions of their descendants in creating this nation. We also are honoring the approximately 4,000 Africans who perished during these ocean voyages to the York River. So is that a part of the marker too? Those figures?
The figures of the 31,000, this said over 31,000.
Yeah, more than
yes,
yeah.
That is included in the marker. Like I said, the right half of the marker will be specific to the region.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just for the York River, given the mortality rate on the Middle Passage voyages, we said approximately 4,000, could have been more, because this was the earlier part of the voyage experience, so that they hadn't gotten a lot of it down to the point where there would be a lower mortality rate on the voyages. So, you know, we're honoring all, and we will have school children who will say the names of all of the 55 African nations, and for each nation to put a carnation into the water in honor, because we don't know specifically where people came from. We have a general idea, you know, in terms of regions, but who came to Yorktown, you know, we have, based on research of Lorena Walsh, who is, I would say, the expert on the Chesapeake trade. You know, she has said that most folks came out of West Africa, Biafra, and then also down in Angola and Senegambia. Those are, and Ivory Coast, the Gold Coast. So those are the four principal regions, but they also had people coming in from Madagascar, so they also had a portion from East Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And this is based on the ship records. Well, we're just making sure by naming all 55 nations that we include everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's appropriate. And we always insist upon young people calling out the names and putting the carnations into the water for the ancestors.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, well, you're executive director of this organization, Middle Passage Ceremonies and Port Markers Project, and you have a great website, middlepassageproject.org, where people can look at images from previous ceremonies as well as read, you know, the bios for yourself and board members. And you are what you call a self-described community activist, and your work has included children and family advocacy with Washington, D.C. government, and work as a retailer, textile artist, and organizer of a collective artist market. And you've also written an extensive family history in collaboration with family members. And as a facilitator and founder of the project, I want you to talk about, you know, your work, you know, encompasses, you know, municipal and federal civic service, community organizing and training, owning a small business, producing textile art and writing. And those are the principal roads with branches into more personal interests in cultural anthropology, history, and travel. And talk about this, you know, this mission that you have now as a, you know, fulfilling of a vocation and a promise you write to the ancestors. You can talk about that a little bit and sort of where this particular ceremony fits into the overall plan.
Well, I think that you'd have to go back 26 years when someone told me that a friend of mine had said that Toni Morrison was haunted by the ancestors who were basically forgotten and unknown in the Atlantic. And he said, so happy birthday, and, you know, you do something about this. And so I sat on it for a long time, and in 2011 decided that probably the most impact that we could have in terms of remembering ancestors is to go to the places where they originally arrived in the Western Hemisphere and Europe. And for those who live in those port cities in those regions, to gather and to have basically a memorial service. You know, over time, we realized that we needed to do a historical research and statement, which is part of the program. We have also decided that part of the program will involve a Native American community by asking them to bless and clear the area where we will hold the ceremony. And I will tell you that that has been a remarkable response. Because for the most part, Native Americans have said no one has ever asked us permission to do anything on the land. And so they start out each ceremony with a blessing and granting us permission. The historical statement is read. And then we have the unity prayer, which should involve a wide variety of religions, the Christian, we've had Christian, Buddhist, Islamic, Jewish, as well as traditional African. Our argument is, or our position is, that we came here as a very diverse people, and we have become, again, a very diverse people, but everyone has benefited. And so at least to have the religious faith to say a prayer in honor of the ancestors we think is appropriate. And then we completed the ceremony of the program with drumming, calling the ancestors, asking them to join us so that we can honor them. And then little water containers are distributed to those who participate. And for the most part, I would say that the crowds have been from 150 to 300 people. And we have someone of the traditional African faith to lead the libation after an elder has held a chalice in the four directions. And we ask people to call out the names of their ancestors who they know, as well as to make a pouring for all those unknown. And what we're doing, I think, is a healing process. It is connecting again to our past. We don't have to know exactly where we came from. We know we came from Africans. We know we came from a wide variety of people, but certainly our primary definition is the African root. And to acknowledge that and to acknowledge the survival, the struggle, the resistance, I think is crucial for us as a people. You know, our history is not about slavery. Our history is about surviving. And if we can begin to embrace that and to understand that we are the builders of this place, no matter whether we're talking Brazil, Colombia, the United States, Mexico, or Europe, you know, the labor of our ancestors created this wealth. And we need to identify with it. And when I say wealth, I'm not only speaking of monetary. I'm talking about the wealth of a people, of a culture. And we must begin to acknowledge that. So that's what this mission is basically about, a healing, acknowledging of the ancestors, and the ability to learn from that and to move forward. And if we can do that, I think that it would be a wonderful, wonderful accomplishment. There are 40 ports in the United States. They go from New Hampshire all the way around to Texas. And we're only talking Middle Passage ports, those places where Africans arrived directly from the continent. They're not the secondary ports. They're not the domestic or internal trade ports. Only those ports where Africans arrived. And this year, we're focusing on Florida and Virginia because those are the two oldest European African settlements on the U.S. territory. And we're also doing June 2nd, and I really want to put a plug in for this, for those who maybe can't come to Virginia, but they're still on the East Coast or they're traveling and they'll be in the Philadelphia or New York area on June 2nd at Penn's Landing. There will be an all-day program at the Seaport Museum area starting at 8 o'clock and ending at 4. There's a luncheon, there's a film series, because Philadelphia was the entry point for all of those Africans who came not only into Pennsylvania and parts of New Jersey, but onto the Delaware River plantations. So it's catching on in terms of having ceremonies, you know, fundraising for the markers. We're very lucky the National Park Service has assumed responsibility for all of the Virginia markers. So that's been a real boom for us. But the mission is that we have to know our history. We have to know where we started. And when we look back at it, you know, there, I guess Florida is celebrating its 500 years this year, 1513 Ponce de Leon. Well, Ponce de Leon brought Africans with him. You know, so 500 years of history is 500 years of history that includes Africans. Some free, some enslaved, but always at present. And we have to begin to think of it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for how many ceremonies have there been so far?
There have been sponsored by us the three in Maryland. We had in April the first one this year, which was in Pensacola, Florida. Mm-hmm. And then we will have, as I said, August 23rd will be Jamestown. So that we will, Philadelphia and Yorktown are the next two that are closest to today, the May 27th and the June 2nd. And then August 23rd in Jamestown, September 28th in Amelia Island, which is in Florida. And on that particular ceremony, the Gullah Geechee Nation will do the libations for the ancestors, because that's part of that Gullah Geechee corridor that was just approved for funding this week. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the sea islands, what's technically called one of the sea islands, with a vast history of importing Africans. And then Key West has theirs on June 23rd. And that's been ongoing for about 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they
have a really very substantial and continued remembrance. So the other thing that we do on our website is anyone who has remembrance ceremonies for ancestors, we post it, so that people in the areas can go. I think there's one in Montgomery, Alabama, July 7th, and we've posted that. And even though it's not a Middle Passage port, it is an ancestral remembrance.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to continue and to broaden the information so that people can continue.
Yeah, it's really excellent. And so for each one of these remembrances, ceremonies, is there a marker for the ones that are?
There is. Okay. We're pushing Maryland, state of Maryland. In fact, they make a presentation on June 3rd after Philadelphia, to sort of nudge them along to say, you know, come on, you got Baltimore, Annapolis, and Sauterly Plantation in southern Maryland. Let's get these markers up so that when people come to visit these cities, you know, they can read the history themselves. It's not going to be a hidden fact. You know, you come there, you come to the waterfront, or you come to the city. You know, you'll know that this city was also part of an arrival site for Africans. We've already started conversations in New England. We hope to have all those done in 2015. So that's New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. To have all of those done in 2015, starting with conversations in Rhode Island and Massachusetts. So Boston will probably take the lead, and then we will spread out to the other cities in Massachusetts.
Wow, that is so wonderful. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, we're hoping that by 2019, it'll all culminate with Project 1619, which is based in Hampton, and they are raising money for a national monument as the arrival site for the first Africans in the British colony.
Mm-hmm.
So they want a monument.
Yeah.
That you'll be able to see as you're coming into Hampton. That will reflect that history of the 1619 arrival. I have to talk about a quirk here. We did the research. Well, no, we gathered the research. It has already been done on Virginia, and of course, 1619 is the arrival date. There's always competition between all of these cities that talk about there being the first settlements or colonies. So that St. Augustine, because it's Spanish, Plymouth, because it's British, and then Jamestown, they all have this back and forth about who started this settlement, this country. And, you know, I think it's enough to go around for everybody. But in 1620, you know, the Mayflower brought the Pilgrims to Plymouth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by 1719, the Mayflower was bringing in Africans into Virginia. So I always say, when people, you know, sort of talk about my family came over on the Mayflower, we're going to have to say, into which colony are you talking? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Because the Mayflower has played a role in bringing people to the territory, to the U.S. territory.
Wow, that's really fascinating. So are you planning at the end of, you know, the culmination, are you thinking about maybe pulling this together into a book?
Everybody keeps telling me that I should. You know, I'll think about it. You know, maybe. I mean, what I'd like to pull together is a huge remembrance ceremony on the east and west coast of Africa once this is done. You know, for us to say that, you know, we've covered our arrival points and now the story of how Africans got from the village to the coast to be taken needs to be addressed. And those ancestors also acknowledged, because half of the people died before they ever got to the coast. There were 24 million Africans captured. You know, only 12 million made it to the coast. So what happens to those ancestors? And in addressing them, we begin again to uncover some history that's not pleasant. It's not positive, but it needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I've always been interested in the other story, the reverse. You know, okay, so those families that lost relatives to, well, they don't know to what exactly, because they didn't arrive with, I mean, they weren't taken, but, you know, families that might have held that space on the altar for these lost members.
Right.
And, you know, and traditionally, since, you know, we're supposed to have an oral history on both sides of the Atlantic, but specifically in African tradition, it's like, okay, well, what are some of those stories? Who are some of those names that you renamed some of the children that came afterwards to hold that space for them, to hold that spirit? So mm-hmm. I thought that'd be, you know, really wonderful way to sort of we talk about reparations, but to really repair it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, my emphasis is not on anything material.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we need to do our own internal spiritual
mm-hmm.
self-healing, you know, and we don't have to ask permission. We don't have to wait for somebody to do it. We do it ourselves, and that's what this project is.
Mm-hmm.
It's our addressing our history, our needs, who we are, where we're going. I think it helps us focus a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
If we do this project, if we do these ceremonies, if we put these markers up, it's not the answer. It is part of that.
Right.
But it's a big step. It's a big step for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're so happy that, you know, you have taken this on, Anne, and, you know, the ancestors are certainly smiling, I'm sure, you know, that, you know, we're calling their names, you know?
We are known
names.
And unknown, you know.
Right.
They're around me all the time, and
mm-hmm.
they make things happen when it doesn't look like it's possible. They make
yeah.
a way. They've
right.
waited a long time.
mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
yeah.
Well, I don't
yeah.
know. Maybe one of the attributes of that realm is patience.
yes. Yes. For sure, you know,
yeah.
something that we learned. But you know, we don't. We have to be too patient now. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think that this is a perfect time.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
you
certainly.
Know, yeah.
Yeah. What is it? The 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, right?
Exactly.
And the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
Like, Washington.
Okay.
And yeah, there will always be these benchmarks,
mm-hmm.
you know, marking our history, talking about, you know, what we've done, where we've been. And, you know, my real concern is, where are we going?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, if we call on the ancestors, they're there, you know. If we acknowledge them, you know, I think that they help to guide our choices.
Mm-hmm,
but if we just ignore them mm-hmm. or act like they don't exist, don't in a true African tradition, just dismiss all of that tradition, they're silent. There's just so much that they can do unless we open that door.
Right, yeah.
You know, yeah. And they have experience, believe me. I mean, look what they survived. look what they've endured.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, I listened to this man the other day, and he said, I don't care where you are. If you go back 3 generations, where were you? And understand that you have come forward those 3 generations. And now multiply that. And look at where we were on a ship, you know, in the middle of nowhere. And all we had was ourselves. And then look where we are today. You know, and then try to figure out where we ought to be headed. What are our values? What are our sense of ourselves? You know, who have we become? And look at that honestly. And to understand that the past plays a role. And like I said, it's not about slavery. It really is about resistance and the search for freedom. You know, at every step in every generation. You know, sometimes it was a haywire response, and sometimes it was a solid, you know, forward move. but people were never accepted the oppression, the inequality. Nobody, no one ever went along with that like it's okay. We deserve it. And I think that we have to understand if those folks, those 10 million folks could come across that ocean not knowing where they were going, what was going to happen, and they continued. Sometimes with a contract with God, sometimes with a contract with each other, then the least we can do is to honor them. I like the fact that we're having this York County event on Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, great day. Yes, a holiday to honor our departed members of our families. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my next guest is in the studio, Anne. So
okay, thank you, Wanda.
Thank you so much for joining us at each step of the way to tell us sort of where we are on this.
Oh, I will. If you know, I'll just keep you posted. And anybody,
yeah, thank you so much.
www.middlepassageproject.org. And you know, look up the calendar and see if you can come to one of the events. And Wanda, thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay.
All right, you take good care. Bye.
Bye.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm fine, Wanda. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about Project One Voice. One voice, one play, one day. And this play that you all are going to be performing, a soldier's play by Charles Fuller. And you were in the original cast, and you are artistic director for this production at the how many theaters is it going to be?
Well, it's going to be at I think 27 theaters across the country.
Yeah,
all
and
the
in
black
South
theaters,
Africa too, right? That's
yes,
amazing.
And in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And it is the third annual fundraising benefit for black theater in the American theater. And this year, as you said, we'll be reading a soldier's play. Mm-hmm. And in 1981, I was privileged to be one of the original cast members in New York when the play opened under the direction of the very great Douglas Turner Ward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I want to read your bio, and you can tell us more about Douglas Taylor Ward and Charles Fuller and this play and your character that you you created.
Yeah.
Stephen Anthony Jones is artistic director of Lorraine Hansberry Theater, located in San Francisco. And he has worked professionally on stage, television, and film for 40 years. Most recently, he was a core company actor at American Conservatory Theater, ACT, in San Francisco, where he acted, directed, and taught, and where he has been seen in November, Tis a Pity, She's a Whore, Blood Knot, The Imaginary Invalid, After the War, Happy End, Gem of the Ocean, Female Transport, Levy James, Waiting for Godot, Johan, The Three Sisters, The Dazzle, Night and Day, Barry Chow, A Christmas Carol, you were great as Scrooge, and The Ghost of Christmas Past, that was really wonderful. Celebration and The Room, Master Harold and the Boys, that was wonderful. The Misanthrope, The Invention of Love, The Three Penny Opera, Tartuffe, Indian Ink, Hecuba, Insurrection, Holding History, that was good. Seven Guitars, another great one. Othello, Tidal Row, Antigone, Miss Evers Boys, that was wonderful. Clara, Joe Turner's Come and Gone, another great one. St. John.
Yeah, that was with Roscoe Lee Brown, too. Very, very great. You talk about now Roscoe is an ancestor.
He sure is, yeah. And then other local theater credits include Fuente, how do you pronounce
Fuente
it?
Fuente Ovejuna, Berkeley rep.
Mm-hmm. And McGee.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm going to stop you because you're making me sound old, you know.
you just have a real rich rich history in theater. And you received your early training at Caramu House in your hometown of Cleveland, Ohio, and you're the graduate of Yankton College in South Dakota. And other experiences include the Cleveland Playhouse, Berkeley Rep, San Jose Rep, and San Francisco Shakespeare Festival. But, yeah, let's talk about the Negro Ensemble Theater, where a lot of folks got, you know, that's like their stomping ground. And
well, you know, the Negro Ensemble Company was started by Douglas Turner Ward, and it is a theater that is responsible for literally generations of artists who went on to work in film and television or who continued to work in the theater, playwrights, directors, designers. Doug just continued to work with and train and mentor so many people. I mean, the original cast of A Soldier's Play included Samuel Jackson and Denzel Washington and James Pickens, Peter Friedman, Cotter Smith, Brent Jennings, myself, Adolph Caesar, Larry Riley, Charles Brown. Those three brothers are no longer with us, but it was an incredible experience. It was a highlight, I think everyone would say, of a career. And we were all very fortunate to have the benefit of working with Douglas Turner Ward and being in New York at an extremely exciting time. A Soldier's Play was the second play by a black author to win the Pulitzer Prize. Since then, a number of people have gone on. August Wilson more than once, Lynn Nottage, and so on. But at the time, in 1981, it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And Project One Voice, which was founded by Eric McMillan McCall, is an incredible organization which has worked to benefit black theater all across the country and is connecting us in a way that we were, as organizations, that we've never been connected before. Last year we read James Baldwin's Amen Corner, and the year before we read Alice Childress's Trouble in Mind. That was the inaugural year. And I'm really hopeful that the connection will grow and develop in ways that hadn't existed before, and perhaps even start a dialogue between the organizations. You know, this year is the year that we have the National Black Theater Festival also. So I'm hoping when I go to sit
Atlanta?
Down with my... no, it'll be in Winston-Salem. Every other year, it's in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Okay.
And sit down with my colleagues and talk about ways that we can, help each other.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, but A Soldier's Play is just a wonderful play. I think one of the reasons that it endures and is still a script that you can do is because it's really a murder mystery. It deals with the circumstance of the integration of the armed forces during World War II, but at its core, it is a murder mystery. It's a complex, interesting story, and the role of Sergeant Waters, which I'll be reading in our production. We're going to do a staged reading, and that will be at the San Francisco Playhouse on June 17th at 7 p.m., and you can go to the Lorraine Hansberry Theater website, lhtsf.org, and get information about tickets and so forth. But the role of Sergeant Vernon Waters, I think, is one of the great roles in the American theater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about the play. You know, the story is a murder mystery. Tell us a little bit about the characters, particularly the one that you developed. And in this particular program of the Project One Voice, you know, the Lorraine Hansberry Theater, A Soldier's Play, directed by yourself, is featuring Carl Lumley, Aldo Billingsley, yourself, Michael J. Asbury, Nick Childress, Jeff Garrett, Daryl V. Jones, Raphael Jordan, David Moore, Patrick Russell, David Wesley Skillman, and Reggie D. White. So it's really cool to be able to see all these black men on stage. Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
That's also another phenomenal thing about the story.
That was one of the things that, just kind of drew audiences in 1981. It was just seeing that many young black men on stage in that story, and it kind of galvanized people's attention, and it caused the buses to line up for many weeks. We ran for 14 months in New York.
Wow.
And the play also went to the Edinburgh Festival. It was the featured production at the Edinburgh Festival. And we went all over the country. We toured. I toured with that play for 22 months.
Nice.
So it was quite a ride. It was quite exciting. And it was the kind of play that kept you as an artist. It kept you absorbed and kept your attention. Doug was a very demanding director and had very high standards. And then as we began to travel, we had a reputation, the reputation of the quality of the work. And then being with veterans like Adolph Caesar, we were just very fortunate, and as I said before, just an incredibly talented ensemble in the show. And there were other artists, Arthur French and O.L. Duke, David Alan Greer was with us for a time in New York. So some incredible people came together during that production.
So a black officer is sent to investigate the murder of a black sergeant in Louisiana near the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And when he arrives, the company had never seen a black officer.
No, and, none of the men had ever. They had only heard about black officers. There were almost no black officers at that time. And, of course, this, you know, a murder in the South of a black man. The troops were on edge. He was worried that he was not going to receive the cooperation of the top brass in the investigation, and that really the Army didn't care one way or the other. And he proceeds and is a very determined character, Captain Davenport, and he takes his role very seriously as the investigator of the murder. And as he delves into the events that led to the murder, the story unfolds in a way that reveals another issue. You know, I don't want to give away too much.
Okay.
But the if people can if people remember during the time that the play was running, a film was made called A Soldier's Story. And actually, Adolph Caesar and Denzel Washington were, and Larry Riley were in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned that the play got the second Pulitzer. Did Lorraine, African American playwright, did Lorraine Hansberry get the first one?
No, no.
Oh.
It was Charles Gordon. For No Place to Be Somebody.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. That was the first play by an African-American playwright to win the Pulitzer Prize. Mm-hmm. And Charles Fuller's A Soldier's Play was the second. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But Lorraine Hansberry did get one for A Raisin in the Sun, right?
No, she didn't.
No? Oh, I thought she didn't get a Pulitzer. Okay.
No, she didn't get a Pulitzer.
Did.
You know, but
oh,
that was the first Broadway production by an African-American playwright.
Oh. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Lorraine Hansberry's life was cut short by cancer. She died when she was in her 30s. I often wonder what the artistic landscape would be like today in the American theater if you know, she was still with us, because Lorraine Hansberry was absolutely brilliant writer and an activist and just such a strong voice, you know, but it wasn't meant to be. And we will try to carry the organization that's named for her, our theater, the Lorraine Hansberry Theater. Hopefully one of the things that we will do is continue the legacy artistically and intellectually that she left us all, because she was a great woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. The anniversary of her her birthday was just last week. I didn't realize until I saw I guess it's To Be Young, Gifted and Black. Is that the song? No, that's a play
mm-hmm.
too. That was put together after she passed to tell her story.
Mm-hmm.
That she and Malcolm X shared a birthday, May 19th. I'm like, oh wow, that's so cool.
Yeah. I didn't realize
that.
That
was just last Sunday. And yeah, it was really, really phenomenal when I was like, oh, that is so fitting that they would be born on the same day, different years. Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Lorraine Hansberry Theater and your unique, I guess vision and the way that you're taking theater into a lot of different public spaces and introducing Black theater to a lot of different audiences.
Well, right now, Lorraine Hansberry Theater has a program that we call Bringing the Art to the Audience. And what we have done is stage a series of readings with partners. And the partners that the theater has connected with are all over the Bay Area. We've gone up to Richmond and the East Bay Center for the Performing Arts. Jordan Simmons is one of our partners, and that's a partnership that we're very excited about. We took two readings there and just had wonderful success and were embraced by that community. And we've been in downtown Oakland at the Joyce Gordon Art Gallery on 14th. We've also been in Oakland at the High School for the Performing Arts. We've been in San Francisco at the African American Art and Culture Complex. And one of our first partners, the place where we did our first reading, was the Museum of the African Diaspora. We did, I think, three events there. And we've also partnered with the American Conservatory Theater in their costume shop studio space. And we developed a new version of Philip Gotanda's The Wash, a play he wrote 25 years ago. And it's just been a very rich and fruitful set of collaborations that have allowed us to move all over San Francisco and the Bay Area and reach out to audiences who have all responded very positively. And we will continue the program starting again in the fall. We will continue to bring the art to the audience. It introduces us to audiences, and it introduces those audiences to our work, and it helps me get an idea of, what plays I want to consider for upcoming seasons, and what the audience response would be to that work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, have you made your announcement yet for the next season?
We haven't. We haven't talked about bringing the art to the audience. I guess it would be a dual announcement, because we have to talk about some of the plays that we want to read in bringing the art to the audience. And then for the 2013-14 season, we have to talk about what we want to produce. And, again, we're going to follow the same pattern. We hope to produce, stage three pieces. And we would be in both the East Bay and San Francisco, and that's something else. We're also the only theater that is moving back and forth across the Bay as we reach out to our very diverse audience base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how has it been for you as, an actor and a director and now artistic director, and you direct, and then we see you in the play too, and then you have the business of running a theater, one that has a extremely rich legacy here in the San Francisco Bay Area. One, I think, the only Black Equity Theater here, right?
Mm-hmm. We are in our 32nd year. We are an equity theater. We are fully professional. African-American theater, and we try to reach out to the entire Bay Area audience. We, of course, champion the work of African-American playwrights, but one of the, like, as I said before, one of the upcoming things that we will do in the 2013-2014 season involves the play we developed with Philip Gotanda, the very, very fine local playwright who is a Japanese-American. Philip and I have collaborated before. You read the title of a couple of his pieces that I did, Yohin and After the War at ACT. And
yeah,
it's very interesting. Philip contacted me and asked me if I would be interested in working on his play, The Wash, and doing it with African-American actors. And we sat down and talked about it and examined, you know, how we could keep the essentials of the plot and the characters intact and yet transfer a story that was originally about a Japanese-American immigrant family. How could we put that in an African-American context? And what we came up with is something that we're calling the Jamaican Wash Project. And it is now a story that is ensconced in a community of Jamaican-American immigrants. So we have the theme of immigrant life kept intact, and then the story simply unfolds. It was a wonderful adaptation. We see those kinds of things in the theater all the time, and the things that come to mind, of course, are the ones, for instance, that were on Broadway in the past few seasons, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, that Felicia Rashad directed a few years ago with my friend Anika Noni Rose as the star, and James Earl Jones, of course. And recently there was Death of a Salesman. But what Philip talked about, rather than adapting the work of those playwrights that are so mainstream and so well known, why not have a play like his by a Japanese-American author adapted by an African-American theater rather than adapting from the center, adapting from the edges, from one community to the next, and seeing what happens when that kind of fusion occurs. And that is work, I think, that Lorraine Hansberry, were she alive, she would be very enthusiastic about, and we're very excited about the partnership with Philip, and very happy to be working with him. And hopefully those two communities will come together at the Lorraine Hansberry and support that production. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be really wonderful.
Yeah,
it would be really great. And this happened in the past, you know, around plays, you know, like the ones you mentioned that you have been in that Philip wrote. And I remember trying to think, the drummer at the musicologist,
Anthony Brown, yes.
Anthony Brown, yes. He yes. did the score.
Yes, for After,
yeah.
after
the
War.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right, yeah, that was a really marvelous production at ACT. Yeah. I was just thinking about, you know, Stanley Williams and Quentin Easter and Stephen Anthony Jones, you know, sort of connecting with those ancestors, you know, the founders of Lorraine Hansberry Theater in 1981 and their vision, you know, for theater, for, you know, the Black community here in this area, connected to, of course, the larger vision that Project One Voice sort of represents, you know, once a year when, you know, these Black theaters throughout the country are reading and now outside of the country are reading the same play at the same time on the same day. That is just
mm-hmm.
really such phenomenal energy, you know?
Well, it's a wonderful organization, Project One Voice, and connecting all of us on that particular day, Juneteenth, and reading, continuing to champion the work of African American playwrights. You know, we have to continue to remind the entire country that a major part of the American theater is the work of African American artists. We can't say that too much or too often. And part of the mission of the Lorraine Hansberry Theater is to continue to kind of beat that drum and put that idea out there. And we don't just the constituencies we serve involve not just the audience, but those writers and the artists who work in the theater. You know, the Bay Area theater community is a very rich community, fortunately. And the Lorraine Hansberry is very happy to be a place where a number of young artists, African-American, and artists from other backgrounds are able to come and work and continue to develop their craft. We have done the work in bringing the art to the audience. We've read some of the work of young up-and-coming playwrights. One of our own, Marcus Gardley. We read his play, Black Odyssey.
Yeah.
And Marcus's career continues on a steep upward trajectory because he is such a brilliant writer. And his voice in the American theater continues to grow and develop. And it is just a wonderful time to be a professional theater, but in particular, it's a wonderful time to be a professional African-American theater. Of course, Project One Voice addresses the fact that we always are looking for support, both financial and otherwise, and Project One Voice, you know, puts that out there and works very hard every year. This fundraiser on June 17th, the tickets are $25. It'll be at the San Francisco Playhouse on June 17th at 7 p.m. And as I said before, just go to our website, lhtsf.org, and you can find out how to make reservations and get tickets. And we hope that we can pack the house and that a lot of people will join us and become part of that larger community that will stretch from coast to coast and even to South Africa this year as we read Charles Fuller's A Soldier's Play. And I have to say, I take great personal pride in coming back to that play, which was such an important part of my development and is so important to me personally as an artist, because I had the privilege of being part of the cast of the original production of it.
Yeah. So lastly, I wanted to ask you about, you know, Lorraine Hansberry is, you know, a theater without walls right at the moment. And I was wondering, is there a building, you know, for the theater to have like an actual, you know, place that's a permanent venue in the coming future, like near future or like sort of?
Well, I think what you're referencing is the 950 Market project and
okay.
The mid-market development project, which is moving full steam ahead. And it's a complex program which will house more than one theater, but the Lorraine Hansberry would be there. And that is progressing, and there will be more information made public about that in the coming weeks and days ahead. But yes, the plan is, in terms of a permanent home, that we become part of that mid-market development, which would solve real estate problems for a number of artistic organizations and other kinds of nonprofits. Yeah, that is the larger plan. In the meantime, we will continue to serve audiences in the East Bay and in San Francisco, and we're kind of enjoying the fact that we're able to be kind of quick on our feet and hop from one side of the bay to the other and reach out and touch people and audiences all over the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been really nice sort of traveling with Lorraine Hansberry Theater, you know, in these various venues. Some, you know, I mean, there haven't been any that I don't know yet, but it's been really great, you know, meeting different audiences in these different places. And
mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, Lorraine Hansberry's productions were always stellar. So it's just, you know, really, really wonderful. I was just thinking when you were speaking that it seems like the Market Development Project sounds like it's going to be like the Public Theater, or in Southern California where Ben Guillory has his theater, it's one of those places where they have like a whole lot of theaters in one venue, which is really neat. And a lot of times, you know, you want to see plays, other plays too, that you might not know were happening or know where they were, but they're all right there in the same complex. So it makes it really easy to see a lot of theater.
The Bay Area theater community is a rich, diverse mix of all kinds of organizations and points of view, and we're just happy to be a part of it. You know, it's exciting. It's an exciting time. It's an exciting time, and like I said, I'm really hoping that people are going to come out and support one play, one day, one voice project, one voice. And as I said, we'll be at the San Francisco Playhouse on June 17th, a Monday, at 7 p.m.
Right.
And we're just hoping that, as I said, we can pack the house. It's going to be an exciting time. Carl Lumley will be there and a number of other amazing actors that are part of this theater community. And come on out and hear us do this reading of A Soldier's Play.
Right.
You know,
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I just looked at my watch.
I was just going
to
tell you thank you. So we're yes, thank you so much, Steve, for joining us to talk about A Soldier's Play and the One Voice, One Play, One Day on Juneteenth. And I wanted to mention to our audience that all the money that's raised in these various venues, all 27 of them, go to the theater. So so that's a wonderful way for you to show your support. And you don't have to limit yourself to $25. You can give more.
That's absolutely true. Thank you for saying that, Wanda. And thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. It's always great to see you out in the world. And tell your wife I said hi.
I
will. And, I'll be traveling, so I won't be able to see you all do a Soldier's Play. I'm really sorry I'm going to miss that. But good luck on the production.
All right. Thank you so much, Wanda. And you have a good day.
Take good care. You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. So, again, Project One Voice, a third annual stage reading that features black theaters across the United States as well as in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, is happening on Juneteenth. Well, Juneteenth is actually the 18th, but it's all in the same spirit. So Monday, June 17th at 7 p.m. at the San Francisco Playhouse, 450 Post Street, $25. You'll be able to see this stellar lineup of actors do a stage reading of the famous story that was written by Charles Fuller, A Soldier's Play. Just really stellar, and you're going to really, really enjoy it. I'm going to play a song, and then we're going to launch into this wonderful interview that I had with Oakland artist, businessman Mario Kyoto, and he's going to talk about this wonderful sculpture that is finished now. It's a monument. I went by and looked at it. It's in a place in Oakland called Uptown, and it's a real cool place in Oakland. It's got like all these nice apartments or condos, and they face each other, and they've got this great park, a Henry J. Kaiser Memorial Park at 19th and Rashida Muhammad Streets, and it's all fenced in, so I'm really looking forward to it being unveiled on May 31st at 3 o'clock. But you can look over the fence or look between the little, you know, the storm fence and see these busts of these really famous and wonderful humanitarians. Some of them actually called Oakland their home and still call Oakland their home, like Mother Mary who you know was really known for, you know, for feeding the homeless and taking care of, you know, the disadvantaged, and she passed. I didn't even know she was in there. And then, you know, we've got, you know, really famous folks like Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King, and then we've got Malcolm X and Cecil Chavez and Mother Teresa, and it's just really a phenomenal piece, and they're bigger than life. I mean, they just sort of like they're like coming out of the Oakland Hills, so to speak, and it's just really beautiful, you know, sculpture. It's just gorgeous, and you're going to really enjoy seeing it. So we had a great conversation. It was really quite lengthy, and I'm just so pleased. And so we're going to play this piece from the score from, you know, Fela, the musical, and it's called Rain. And then we're going to jump right into the interview.
For the things we know see, we fear for the air around us. We all have reason to fear.
Fela, you have come all this way to ask for my blessing. But I refuse to give you permission to use what happened to me as your excuse to run away. Are you ready to listen now?
Obalogun, obalogun, obalogun.
Obalogun.
The fiercest warrior to ever live. But the Alukopobon, demons who kill with their cries, oh, their cries, their terrible cries, monsters that kill with their terrible cries. In their fury, the Alukopobon, Pobon,
Alukopobon, Pobon.
Shook their manes and charged. But Obalogun no run. He stopped his ears with dirt, and loading the demons into his arms, he burst into flame, cleansing the earth. Yemaya, Yemaya, Yemaya.
In the murder of the gods,
Yemaya saw her son burst to flame. She cried, tears of loss, tears of pride. Oh, how she cried.
Ah!
rage. Let the demons cry. Let the mothers weep. Let the bullets fly. Even if you must die, go back to where you belong. Let the battle
is coming to town next month, June 4th through 9th at the Paramount Theater. They're going to be ending their tour there. And again, you can get discounted tickets by calling 800-745-3000 and giving the discount code AFROS, A-F-R-O-S. And I wanted to mention again Mother Mother Mary Wright, and also wanted to pour a libation and ashe for David Glover, founder of Occur, who just made his transition this week. So without further ado, we're going to play this wonderful interview with Mario Kyoto, artist of the wonderful monument, Remember Them, Champions for Humanity, and just really phenomenal work, and you're going to really enjoy it. So don't want to miss the unveiling. Again, that is Friday, May 31st, next Friday, 3 o'clock at the Henry J. Kaiser Memorial Park, 19th Street and Rashida Muhammad Streets in Oakland. So here we are.
Okay.
Yeah. So how do you pronounce your last name, Mario?
It's actually pronounced Kyoto.
Kyoto. Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, it sounds Japanese, but it's actually Italian.
Yeah, I noticed that you're an Italian ancestry, and
right.
You sound like you're like a child artistic prodigy.
I'm not sure what I am sometimes, but, the art is, it's kind of threaded into me, because, and I say that because as far back as I can remember,
mm-hmm.
was that impulse to want to articulate through creating. And I mean, I'm talking way back, even on the walls of my crib, they kept photos of stuff that I was scribbling on. And
wow.
I don't know. It's just one of those weird things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then your style is, you know, so classic. I mean, and, you know, sort of like the kind of art that, you know, the Renaissance period is just really, really big and has that old feel to it, like classics, even like the Greeks and stuff.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because there's no question that as I got older, especially during my adolescence,
mm-hmm.
I was really exposed to Michelangelo and Rodin.
And
that really just got me so excited.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to emulate them. And that's how I practiced. You know, I would copy things that they did. And anywhere I could copy, I would practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it always stuck with me. And I don't have, you know, this thing that everything has to be one kind of art or one kind of style. I see all around the country different cultural affairs departments and art commissions, and they're always trying to advocate a certain style, which I kind of think is is wrong. It should be every type of style, from super real to abstract, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, art's supposed to reflect how we feel about things, and everybody feels different.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So talk about, you know, this big, you know, this huge major project in Oakland that's mm-hmm. going to have its unveiling on May 31st at 3
right.
o'clock. It's going to be so
yeah.
exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting. You know, it's been going on for about 12 years, a little over 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
The first time that the inspiration and the feeling hit me was literally minutes after I saw the airplanes crashing into the Twin Towers
mm-hmm.
On 9/11, 12 and a half years ago.
Yeah. It's amazing that it's been 12 and a half years, huh? It seems like yesterday.
In some ways, it seems like it's been in an instant, and in some ways, it seems like an eternity.
Mm-hmm.
But it was that moment that everything kind of became very clear to me. I for two decades leading up to that time, have been very successful in creative businesses, including I was the president of a public company that specialized in a lot of movie and Halloween and seasonal products that were worldwide. And, you know, art was obviously my life,
mm-hmm.
but there was always something missing. And I always had this idea long before 9/11 about how, you know, what could I create or do that could have an impact on people to get along better? I mean, that was it in its simplest form.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt a little guilty almost as an artist, because artists tend to struggle a lot. And yet I was doing so well, and it came so easy, even though I worked extremely hard. And there was this big empty spot. And then 9/11 hit, and also I would add, I would always have been a fan of history and the change makers, and you know, I always followed the lives of Lincoln, Churchill, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King,
mm-hmm.
Frederick Douglass. These were all these people who inspired me.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I never knew what to do with all that. And then it hit me, after I saw the Twin Towers, we really need to start creating things that encourage people to see how much they are alike and not unalike, and to find those common denominators. Because, you know, 9/11, the first thing that happened was, oh, well, those people from those Muslim countries are all bad people.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the news and the media spread like wildfire. And yet we all know that it was an extremist action of a very few people. And I thought if I could create something that shows the similarities in people, maybe it's a starting point. I don't pretend to have all the answers or this is the definitive way. But if we have reminders, all of these people from different cultures, that they all went through hardship, they all gave themselves up for other people's benefit, and that it was not expected from these people, that just ordinary people like you and I can make a difference, and we can affect people for the betterment,
mm-hmm.
and that we are not so much the black, the white, the Asian, the this, the that, but we are the human race. And you hear that periodically from people, but it's like people forget about that. That, you know, we all come from the same planet, and no one can deny that, regardless of what you believe in.
That's so true.
So
mm-hmm.
so that's how it started, even though, I mean, that's how the Remember Them Monument was born, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That's its conception, although the idea for years, I mean, I'm going back to teens thinking
mm-hmm.
about what can I do.
Mm-hmm.
And everything I did, you know, came to be used as some part of this in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I made the conscious decision to literally stop doing my regular commercial work. I thought it was only going to be a 2 or 3 year journey.
Mm-hmm.
It's 12 and a half years now.
Yeah.
It totally changed my lifestyle. When I first introduced the idea, there were not very many people who really got it. And if anything, people said, you know, nice airy-fairy idea, it'll never happen. The only person who supported me initially
mm-hmm.
was the Oakland Chamber of Commerce, the president, which is so ironic because the president, Joe Herberta, the president of the Chamber of Commerce,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think this was a big leap for him. Very conservative and government-oriented person. And, you know, I was talking about bringing everyone into the fold and put them all on an even keel. And he absolutely embraced it, supported it. Probably we could not have done it without him
mm-hmm.
and him helping and championing the cause. But it was funny because right after 9/11 and right when I started doing the initial sketches and talking about it, I sent out over 500 proposals nationwide. And a handful came back, and it was always the typical thing. Nice idea, but we don't see how this physically could ever happen.
Hmm.
So I bit my bullet, and I made a huge decision to, as I said, stop my regular commercial business. I took all my resources of the time.
Wow.
And funded as far as I could go.
Mm-hmm.
And in the third year, Kaiser Permanente saw it more developed. So you had a clear picture of what this was going to be, and they really embraced it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we knew no matter how long it was going to take to do, it was going to happen.
Oh, okay.
And there were so many times during these 12 years that we were going strong and then funding would end,
mm-hmm.
and then it was like, what are we going to do now?
Hmm.
And somehow, some way, in between, you know, the starving to make it happen, we managed to continue to go. People would step up when we least expected it. I mean, it's been, I could have never scripted this journey. It was certainly more difficult than I originally thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm. So in the third year, was that when you had the Maya Angelou came and Ruby Bridges, grown woman?
Actually,
was that
Maya Angelou came very early on.
Okay.
Yeah, she came very early on, and she was one of the people who really inspired me and pushed me
mm, nice.
To keep going.
Mm-hmm.
That was about 2002, maybe it was actually just before 2003.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And she came to the studio, it was a private thing, she just showed up. And her voice, very stern, said, I understand you're trying to make a monument about humanity. And she came in,
mm-hmm.
and she didn't say a word. She just stared at the model for about a minute, and then she broke down crying, and she said, it was about time.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, no words are necessary. I get it. And that, we had extensive conversations after that. I've gotten to know her son really well.
Yeah, Guy.
I've been fortunate enough to be involved and participate in activities with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, in about early 2007, late 2006,
mm-hmm.
You may be referring to that event.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And which is funny because the time is just flown by.
Yeah,
but it was a while ago.
Yeah, and you released Doves.
Yes. Now that was the 2011 event.
Oh, that was 11. Oh, so 7,
yeah.
11. Okay.
Yeah, that was the 2011 event.
Okay.
There have been so many events, so much fundraising, so many awareness
mm-hmm.
Meetings to to do this, so many public hearings
mm-hmm.
to get it passed. Along the way, I met some incredible people that I would have never otherwise have met, and can honestly say they're friends who I speak with on either a daily or weekly basis, like Ruby Bridges,
mm-hmm.
like Ambassador Shabazz, who is Malcolm X's oldest daughter.
Nice.
Juliana Roosevelt, who now mm-hmm. we collaborate and work on projects together.
Mm, really? She's like what?
She's a landscape architect.
Oh.
And her cause is very similar to our cause, where we are trying to change environments that are not expected, that could make a difference in urban areas or questionable areas. And she and I are working on a project in Richmond, California, together that is the beginning of something that we think is very, very special.
Oh, nice.
And we'll make everyone more aware of it as the designs, I've been working on the designs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really this, it's part of this much bigger plan that evolved from Remember Them, that we kind of have coined the Freedom March of Art to try to bring it to the areas where it actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And in areas, again, where you're not expecting it to happen.
Hmm.
Because this entire Bay Area is a tremendous hotbed of history that most people don't know about. And, you know, between Oakland and Richmond alone, so much happened before the Civil Rights Movement
mm-hmm.
that is not really in very many books. I mean, most people don't know that this was one of the very first places that you had a business, namely under Henry J. Kaiser, that stopped segregating employees and did equal pay for equal work for both, regardless of your race or religion, and whether you were a man or a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he fired entire executive staffs who tried to oppose him on that. And there are a lot of other things that happened here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have the whole Native American Ohlone Indians who were born here that most people don't know anything about that history, and it needs to be told.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Then you have the immigrants coming from Italy, from
mm-hmm.
Germany, from China, from the turn of the century. You know, up until the 60s, that was such an important part of what happened here. You had Henry J. Kaiser in the 30s who put out the call to African Americans in the South to come work over here to create the planes and the ships that, you know, would protect this country.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first one to do a health program for people, for employees. Most people don't realize that that was the first of its kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, I mean, the story.
And then we look at Kaiser Permanente now, right?
Yeah, and you know, the irony of that, Kaiser Permanente was the smallest thing he did.
Mm.
And yet, that's what we all see. Nobody really understands what he did. And, you know, he had a basically a sixth grade education.
Hmm.
And, you know, I mean, and that's just one microcosm of this area. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, but then, you know, back to Kaiser, I mean, there was that great exhibit at the Oakland Museum, and then you saw, you know, that he was also international. I think he built a dam in Ghana.
Oh, yeah. Franklin Roosevelt said he was the guy who should have been president of the United States. But I believe Henry J.'s. And he told him, you should run. And he said, I'll run as fast as I can away from politics.
Mm-hmm.
And he's probably smarter for that. But it's not just Henry Kaiser. I mean, there's mm-hmm. so many other stories in
mm-hmm.
this area that
yeah.
need to be remembered. And the funny thing is, there are stories everywhere. And we need to recognize that telling those stories is a very powerful thing that helps people and helps the environment. and encourages, you know, creating and being reverent about things as opposed to destroying or destructive nature.
Yeah, because you and you mentioned you know, other heroes from this area, like Dr. Marcus Foster and Carmen Flores. I don't know Carmen Flores.
Carmen Flores was basically a, you know, a bright spotlight in the local area for people of Hispanic background who really had nowhere to go. She helped with education. She helped local government to try to help create programs. I mean, we, among the circles who know her, she is kind of considered the female Cesar Chavez, because she stayed in this area. She didn't go beyond this area, whereas Cesar Chavez, as you know, is national and internationally known. But Carmen did it here.
Hmm.
And her roots are still here. Her family's still here.
So is she a contemporary of, or was she a contemporary of Dolores Huerta?
They were partners, basically.
Okay, so they were all together. Okay.
Yeah, they were all together at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason why you see both of them
mm-hmm.
on the monument.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have Alida Abrams, who's also on the monument.
Mm-hmm.
This is a local champion
mm-hmm.
who did so much for helping victims of rape.
Oh, nice.
That before was non-existent,
mm-hmm.
and it was secretly done with Oakland Police Department officers who mm-hmm. did this totally on their own time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, and also on this current section,
mm-hmm.
you have Royal Towns,
mm-hmm.
who was the first African-American fire captain and formed organizations to allow young African-Americans to integrate into the fire department in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And most people don't know, he didn't get paid. He had to do it as a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only way he could do it.
Uh-huh.
And he's on that.
Mm-hmm.
Ina Colbreth is on.
Oh, great! Yes.
Yeah. Yes, it sounds like you know who she is.
Yeah. She was a librarian, and she was the first. Yeah, poet laureate. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yes, she was the first poet laureate, and she started the. She was the first librarian,
mm-hmm.
but what most people don't know is how she got here.
How'd she get here?
She got here, she escaped from Utah. She was the granddaughter or daughter of Joseph Smith. And because she did not want to be married at 12 years old.
Mm-hmm. 12?
Yes.
Hmm.
And she made her way over here. She was really into literature. And she had kind of like a boarding house. And she had all the local authors stay there, including Jack London.
Nice.
And, you know, I mean, these are pretty unbelievable people during their time
mm-hmm.
of what they've done. And we also have Ansel Hall.
Hmm.
And most people don't know who Ansel Hall is. Ansel Hall was the person who started the National Park Services. Became the National Park Services. He started with the East Bay Regional.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, for protecting the environment,
mm-hmm.
Really making the hills look like the way they do.
Yeah.
We're hoping one of his family members will be there. And then the other local champion
mm-hmm.
that I put on there that I felt was really important was an Ohlone woman.
Mm-hmm.
There are very few to little stories of the specifics about the Ohlone, specifically people, a person. And I wanted to recognize the fact that they are the original people here. They're the people who started life, human life here.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to be remembered. And I consider the women or the woman You know, that's the life giver.
Mm-hmm.
It's rarely a life taker. And that, to me, that's one of the highest symbols that you could have.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need a name for that, of that person.
Right, yeah.
So,
do you have any other images or people that are representative of a larger idea? You know, like the Ohlone woman?
On section four of the
project? On the project in general.
Well, there's a total of 40 people
mm-hmm.
represented on the monument. There's 26 on the front side
mm-hmm.
and then the 14 on the sides and spiraling around.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the makeup, it almost pretty much encompasses the whole world, someone from each continent or a few people from each continent.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, in the process, I was trying to create something that could, you know, speak to different people. That was intentional.
Mm-hmm.
But what wasn't intentional that I found kind of extraordinary is that when I came up with the final group, it really covered all the continents.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to like all these people, but there'll be someone there that you can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also important to note that I don't consider this like the definitive, you know, 40 people of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
I consider these just tremendous examples of people who made sacrifices for other people, and they come from all over the world. And it's a starting point. It's not an ending point. And it's a reminder for us. It's really about awareness. Because if you can get people to be aware, you trigger a lot of other things. You trigger, you know, education. You trigger hope, which you hopefully leads into people taking action for the betterment of others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but just noticing how you have, you have Nelson Mandela, you also have, you know, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., and a lot of times, you know, Abraham Lincoln, you don't have some folks that you have depicted in the same conversation. So
well, I'm glad you're saying that. That's very true. When I did my research and I was studying other monuments and
mm-hmm.
seeing what's out there, what attracts people, what makes people just walk by and not notice and whatever, just studying monument after monument.
Mm-hmm.
It was shocking to me that no matter where I looked, it was always, well, this is the war monument, this is the white monument, this is the black monument, this
mm-hmm.
is the Asian monument, the Jewish monument. Nowhere is there a monument to humanity. There's some that insinuate, but they don't freely say it. And having Winston Churchill next to Malcolm X
mm-hmm.
is clearly a first. And I come back to why would someone do that? Because they gave of themselves to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
That is the simplest and most important factor of what the common thread is among all of them,
mm-hmm.
that they were selfless for other people's benefit.
Right, yeah.
So I am proud of the fact
mm-hmm.
that we have, you know, it's clearly not everyone in the world there, but there is representation from all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And you have people, you know, a lot of times when you see monuments, the person died. And you've got people that are alive and, you know, that are still with us in this you know, in this monument, you know, besides Maya Angelou, who we've been speaking about quite a bit, you know, Ruby Bridges, as you already mentioned, Cesar Chavez just passed. You know, we've got...
Well, it was important to me
mm-hmm.
that we have real-life living people so that young people in particular can see that these people are real and not just myths and the distortions of writings through histories that keep twisting the discerning what people in history have done,
mm-hmm.
so that people can see for themselves, look, this person exists, they continue to do great things, and they also are just like you and me, imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is an important part. And the sad thing I have to say is when I started this project, Coretta King was alive, Rosa Parks was alive,
mm-hmm.
and that was hard when they passed away because I had just made contact with both of them.
Oh, wow!
And I've always hoped that, you know, that they would have been at this dedication. I've been lucky enough that not all of them, but most of them, there's been some representation who has visited
mm-hmm.
the Remember Them site or my studio during these years.
That's great. Yeah, because I know that, you know, you have, and I'm not certain how to pronounce correctly, but Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yes, Thich Nhat Hanh.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and Rigoberta Menchu Tum.
Yes.
And Eli Wiesel.
Yeah, Wiesel.
Wiesel,
yeah. The funny thing about Thich Nhat Hanh is, first of all, most people don't realize how old he really is, and he's alive.
He doesn't look that old, does he? I mean, you would never think 1926, like, for real?
No, and the irony of that one was when we had the unveiling back in 2011.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really wanted him to be there because we were corresponding, and there were some problems with his travel and whatnot. And that was on a Friday or Saturday, Friday that we unveiled it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I believe. I can't quite remember. Whatever it was. The next Monday, I got a call from Governor Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I need you to come to my office in Oakland. I have a surprise for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I, of course, went over there, and I walk into the office, and there's Thich Nhat Hanh waiting.
Wow.
And we walked over to the monument.
Mm-hmm.
And what an experience it was with him, and to hear him talk. And I mean, I'm telling you, there's no way this man's 87 years old, and he looks like he's about 38 or 40.
Mm-hmm.
And just everything he said was just with such a positive energy that just was what he said and what was around him. And you know, he talked about so many different things, and then we got to have an afternoon tea with him. It was a real highlight for me in this entire project to actually be with him. It was for a full day then, and to hear him talk. He was so humble about everything, and he's so funny, and that's the other thing. You think it's going to be serious, and yet he's almost childlike. And always cracking a joke, and always taking everything in, and observing everything. It was quite an experience.
Mm-hmm. So did you have a team helping you, or did you sculpt every piece yourself?
Well, this is the process. There's a smaller scale model that is made first, mm-hmm. and that I do from start to finish. All the drawings, the mm-hmm. design. Every time I make a full scale sculpture, you have to do a smaller version to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, I mean, there's hundreds of studies I did and testing, trying to figure out how the, you know, the positions of the faces, who's going to be there. Then came the scaling up. And I have a team of artisans who work with me, who have been with me quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And they help me do the mathematical scale up to a certain point. And then the last finish on everything, the skin of everything, everything that you see with your eyes down about 2 inches deep,
mm-hmm.
I sculpt all of that
mm-hmm.
on top of the structure that's built.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, I get my hands on every inch of it. And, you know, I make sure that it's, you know, every line, crease, eyeball,
mm-hmm.
ear, hairline, everything is as I do it. There's rock work on this one that I did have my assistants help with.
Mm-hmm.
They worked on, but the actual people, the faces, the bodies, the hands, all of that I do I do all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are they a part of your Kyoto Art organization, you know, your business?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, they've all been with me a long time. And then we expand and contract according to projects that
mm-hmm.
we're working on.
Hmm.
You know, for most of the period of Remember Them working on it, I could not take other projects because it was, you know, it was like an octopus. There were so many parts to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the difficulty of the whole thing. It just, you know, I was locked in it. And most people need, you know, you need to take on other business to, you know, to pay bills and do whatnot financially. As I came to the end of 2011, we opened up the doors again to taking on projects that would be related to social justice projects.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea what was going to happen. And to my pleasant surprise, I was hit with kind of a wave of projects that are related.
So is that the Contrabands and Freedom Movement Monument in Alexandria, Virginia? Was that one of them?
Yeah, that's one of them. That's that, and we are finishing that right
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, is a tribute to, I don't know if you know the story or not, but that's where they uncovered 1,200 graves that these were the people who migrated from Savannah to Alexandria, Virginia, who most of them thought they were coming into freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they said it was a free state at the time, really wasn't.
Oh, so they were going back into slavery?
They were treated worse than slaves. They were put into barracks with any excuse. It's a terrible, terrible story, but the good part of the story are those people who endured and helped and made sure that, you know, a good number of them would survive. But this particular project is at the gravesite that even the city had, no pun intended, buried, and the Department of Transportation had built roads over. And then about 7 years ago, by accident, they started uncovering graves for some repair.
Mm-hmm.
And then, long story short, they wanted to put a memorial there. And there was all kinds of controversy. Even my being awarded the project, I had submitted my models and didn't think anything of it. I figured, you know, if we get this, I will be so happy. But, you know, there's other people that are probably there and closer.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, I found out I was awarded the project through the newspapers.
Mm.
The actual city hadn't even contacted me.
Wow.
Because there was so much controversy. There was so much misinformation. One person who thought he had won really didn't, but he was telling everybody that he won, and I had gotten wind of that through the newspaper, and I kind of just said, okay, well, they chose someone else, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
When I found that out, I thought, you got to be kidding me, this is a prank call. But anyway, I'm so proud and so happy that I was awarded it. I really put a lot into that. And again, I consider that an extension of Remember Them.
Oh, certainly.
The reason they chose me, at least a lot of the judging panel, I would find out later, said that, you know, we saw what you were doing in Oakland,
mm-hmm.
and we really wanted something like that, but reflective of Contraband Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
But also in this last year,
mm-hmm.
that did not have any controversy associated with it. And again, another one I'm very proud of is the Harriet Tubman Thomas Garrett Memorial in Wilmington, Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another one that I really was able to get my mind wrapped around it and,
mm-hmm.
there's just this funny thing that happens. You know, there are projects you get because you have to do them and it's a job, and then there's the projects you get where your mind and body goes on automatic pilot on a different level that you can't explain. And that was one of them, where I started sculpting the models, and just I went like 3 days in a row with very little sleep until I finally got what I wanted.
Anyway. That's
and
awesome.
Then
go ahead.
I was just going to say, the other thing I'm working on that is really something close to me in different ways. Believe it or not, when you hear the title, you'll wonder why, but there are reasons for it, personal reasons. I'm working with the Golf Hall of Fame, the World Golf Hall of Fame, and we are creating a traveling exhibit and monument for a tribute to African Americans in golf. And I can't even tell you just the euphoria of being involved with that project. It doesn't feel like work. It's a dream come true project.
Yeah, why is that? Are you a golfer?
Well, you know, yes is the short answer. So I did not take up golf till much later in my life. I thought it was very elitist. I thought it was a waste of time. I didn't understand it until I was in my mid-40s when I first took it up. And then suddenly I would be exposed to this entire different world of history that I had never seen before, with all kinds of life lessons. And it sucked me into it in a way that is unexplainable. I can't even give you the proper words right now of why it's so important and how many people it will reach, for example, this traveling exhibit, to get people into it who normally have not been exposed to it.
And so the World Golf Hall of Fame is in St. Augustine, Florida?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I hope it comes here. I think you probably...
The exhibit ultimately will come here.
Good.
And it's, you know, where I'm in the beginning stages of designing it. The models are all here. We are really, really excited. That's what I can tell you.
Well, it sounds like you're excited about all your projects.
They're
your kids. Yeah, well, hey, it's a lot to be excited about. And then I noticed that, you know, you have curriculum that's available, you know, to accompany people who are teachers. Dr. Claiborne Carlson, you know, has been, collaborating with you to develop this this curriculum, and he's, like, phenomenal.
Well, it's a huge honor getting to know Clay. And talking hour upon hour with him when we started this project. And just the history he brings, he himself, Clay Carson. And then in addition to that, though, one of the things we've done is we along the way, engaged the Oakland school system to participate in creating part of the curriculum. That, you know, it's been a moving target, because you have to remember, when we started this project 12 and a half years ago, the, you know, communication system in the tech world was a little bit different back then. And so we've had to evolve with that. And along the way, we brought more people in and, you know, to try to address the, you know, this isn't about names, dates, and places. This is about transformations that people can make in their lives, just like these people on the monument. And, you know, we're excited because people are, classrooms are using it. I get letters all the time. I'm asked to speak at schools. Part of what we've done over these 12 years is I've always had an intern program that I targeted teens from the inner city. And, you know, we did the practice on them so that, you know, we knew what we were dealing with, and they knew what they could ultimately achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been a really good feel-good story, but we can't just leave it where it's at. This is an ongoing thing that can never stop.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
And it is my hope that, you know, the educational world and whoever drives it understands that it is creating, empowering youth to create is what will change their lives for the better. And I'm not saying everyone to become a, you know, a sculptor or an illustrator. Creating is writing, creating is math, creating is sciences. And if we take away our arts, I think that's really the lead subject matter in realizing you can be a creator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my hope and what I kind of fight for constantly. And that's why we bring in the interns. You know, they never have to pay anything. I just, you know, we interview who's the most interested in doing this, and I take as many as I can take.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's excellent. I was reading that there is Remember Them Educational Monument that's on the spiraling axis, emulating the helix of the common DNA of all humans, and then you're working on something else around that particular premise.
Well, actually, a lot of my work, that is the shape that I start with, including Remember Them. If
okay.
you look at it,
mm-hmm.
you'll see that it is actually a helix.
Mm-hmm.
It's a broken helix. At one time, it was one unit,
mm-hmm.
but I thought better people to be able to walk around it.
Right.
But the shape of the helix is exactly, your DNA, or anyone's DNA, is what, 99.99999% similar to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the symbol that, look, we all come from the life, same life force. Why are we separating and segregating each other so much? And that's kind of the reason why you see in so many of my works, including Contraband Freeman,
mm-hmm.
that it's done on the shape of the helix.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it looks nothing like Remember Them,
uh-huh.
but it evolves from the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So that's your signature?
It's kind of my signature. I don't do it in everything, but I try to tell a story whenever I can with that shape.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is really phenomenal. And you're a young man, so you've got a whole lot more art in you.
Young man, I'm already 52.
Oh, you are a young man. We live a long time nowadays.
Yeah.
So you got.
Well, as long as I can keep doing it, I'm always going to do it. And I have no idea how long this journey is going to last, but I'll keep following it as long as I can.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were speaking, you know, about master. Buddhist priest Thich Nhat Hanh, and you say, you know, he was born in 1926, and he looks like he's 38, you said, or something like that,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, he's happy, and he's, in himself, and so you're really happy, you know, and you're doing...
I'm very happy, but I can assure you I have stress.
Well, you must know how to meditate or something. You know, pull out some tools and carve something,
yeah.
Right?
Well, I will say this. I am so happy doing my work. I'm mm-hmm. happy to be an artist. I'm happy to help people whenever I can. But the reality is it does come at a price. And unfortunately, in those 12 years, it was not easy on my family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they paid a huge price because in order for me to pull it off, I had to spend basically 12 hours a day here almost every day, 6 and 7 days a week. And that was not easy. That was this is probably the one area that is the hardest for me to reconcile with. I loved everything I've done on this project,
mm-hmm.
but it was a very difficult thing to juggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess at a certain point, you can't necessarily share, you know, like the actual work. It has to be something that you can do only. I guess you're the only one that can do it. Similar to like writers,
Yes. I think that's a good fair assessment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a certain isolation. You know, and you think about, you know, these freedom fighters, you know, that you have depicted in this wonderful work. You think about Cesar Chavez and, you know, how much time he spent away from his family, you know. And
well, it's funny that you say that, because along this 12-and-a-half-year journey,
mm-hmm.
I never thought that that would become something I would seek in the reading about these people.
Mm.
And yet, at times it did become, because of my own family and having to be isolated away from them for long periods of time. And I tried to figure out, how did they deal with it? How did Abraham Lincoln deal with it? How did Cesar Chavez? How did Martin Luther King? And I had a tremendous conversation with Juanita Abernathy about this.
Oh, nice.
And Juanita Abernathy's husband, of course, is on the monument,
yeah.
Ralph David Abernathy.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to spend the night there in Atlanta and
mm-hmm.
be with her and the family. And she talked about that, and she said that they accepted it the way it was, but she said, I can assure you not everyone who did the movement or fought for these causes accepted it as well as she did.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause she said she knew that, you know, he was doing something for a much bigger cause, and it wasn't about him. But she, I think she also is the same makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't expect that out of everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but
that's
true. It is interesting, all of them, every one of them, with the exception of probably Ralph Abernathy and Juanita Abernathy, all had challenges
mm-hmm.
in their families and marriages, because, you know, you basically, when you take this journey, you're no longer yourself. You're owned by other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in a symbolic and literal way, I hate to say it.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a sacrifice, you know, when, you know, a new book just came out early this year when Rosa Parks would have been 100 years old, and it's called The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. And in the book, Dr. Thea Harris, you know, she talks about how Rosa Parks and her family, they had to leave town. They had to go to Detroit, Michigan. She could no longer live, you know, where she was born and raised anymore after the bus boycott, because they got, you know, calls, you know, with threats, and they couldn't get a job and all the hate mail. And
yeah,
it was just a tremendous, and her husband, I think he had a heart attack, and, you know, she had to be hospitalized. I mean, it's like people who, you know, try to help us be better human beings.
Well,
in their work,
bringing up a hot topic, because
mm-hmm.
again, you could look at everyone on that monument,
mm-hmm. yes.
and they all had huge challenges with
mm-hmm.
the people who were close to them. I mean, from Franklin Roosevelt, and I've been fortunate enough. I mentioned to you that, you know, I work with Juliana Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been very forthright about some of the stories, and what the media portrays and what really happened are two different things. But
mm-hmm.
but the family did suffer,
yeah.
because they had their mission to do, and they kind of, there's a relinquishing, I think, when you read about all of them, that, you know, this is what I got to do, and it's for the betterment of others, and I'm just here on the journey to help facilitate. And all of them, Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill, at some point they all talk about that in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, it's a common thread.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
another common thread, exactly. And it didn't matter what part of the world you came from. It's the
mm-hmm.
it's a cold, hard fact. Not too many on there with
mm-hmm.
what you would call happy marriages or marriages at all. In
mm-hmm.
some of the cases.
Yeah, yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, they were totally true public, they are true public servants.
Yeah, yes, and not, exactly, and not elected, so to speak.
No.
But from a much higher source or,
mm-hmm.
or power.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And you are certainly called, you know, to you know, this service, you know, using art to bring to life, you know, these lives and these spirits. And just think, wow, Oakland is such a great place to have this work, you know, where people can go, and if they're, you know, people don't even have to be sighted. I mean, because you have, they can, people, you know, people that are, you know, don't see, they can feel the actual images, you know, with their hands. And I think there's Braille there as well. People can read.
Oh, yeah, for the
vision impaired. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you saying that. I should say, for sure, I do feel some kind of higher force is pushing me, because honestly, I don't know how I've gotten through some of this. But I happen to also believe everybody has some kind of calling. They just have to listen for it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, put aside all the material things for a brief time and say, well, why am I here? What is it I love? And, you know, how do I relate to people?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all these things, you start to think about them when you're alone and it's, you know, 12:30 at night and you're sculpting the head of Abraham Lincoln and you're wondering, you know, what would he have said or what would he have done in this time? Or Chief Joseph. You know, how would the world have perceived him in this day and age? And you all kinds of stuff goes into your head, believe me. And, you know, and it's almost surreal sometimes. And I think it is part of the creative process, especially when you get closer and closer to this unexplainable feeling that your hands start to work on their own, things that you could not create before, that you spent months on, you suddenly materialize in minutes. It's a reminder to me that there's something more than just, you know, computers and cell phones and iPads, that there really is something divine here.
Mm-hmm.
And that we are all related and connected to that divinity. We just have to see it. And we have, and probably the biggest gift of the universe is if you really, really think about it. And this is coming from me, and people can believe what they want. But we really are free to choose whatever we want to do, in spite of all these man-made obstacles and prejudices. We can do whatever we want, and that's the biggest gift to all of us. That, you know, it may not be fair, the circumstances you're in, but if you want to pursue something, you can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I pursued what was my natural impulse, and that's art.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, and a lot of times with our children in particular, they might not know what's available when they decide to choose one direction or one path over another. So with this wonderful exhibit, you know, this wonderful sculpture, you know, that's in the public space, which means it's always accessible. You don't have to pay. You don't have to wait for the doors to open.
Right.
People
right.
can just go and meditate and contemplate these various beings, you know. I mean, it took you 12 years, you know, to finish it. You know, it could take a person a lifetime to just try to understand and unpack, you know, the spirits that are depicted there. And so a young person, you know, they might know a name, but then just to go and sit and meditate on, you know, an icon, just go, you know, I just started thinking about what would this person do in my circumstances? What choice would they make? And then, you know, choose the better path as opposed to the easier path.
Well, there's so much to it, and it's excellent what you are bringing up, because there's so much to be learned by these people.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we learn by making mistakes, but, you know, they all made mistakes to get where they, you know, to their achievements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we don't have to make the same ones.
You don't have to make the same ones, and I think one of another common thread among all of them with this regard is that they all took responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't blame someone else. for something. They took action. And I think that's an important piece to this also.
Mm-hmm.
And that everybody has that ability. I think that goes hand in hand with this, what I was talking about earlier, about freedom being our greatest gift. But understanding, you know, there's the freedom of the universe, and then there's the freedom that I call the man-made freedom that I think is not really free.
Mm-hmm.
And
it expires.
Yes. You know, I mean, without getting into too much on it, but really, you know, to people need the right to choose how they want to live, and as long as they're not hurting anybody else. And there are still issues with that in this day and age.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, deep down, if you go to a higher thinking, you realize, you know, I am really free to choose. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I won't batter that any longer.
Yeah, well, this has been such a lovely conversation. And I was wondering, is it a surprise who you're expecting to be in town for the on the 31st at 3 at the Henry J. Kaiser Memorial Park, 19th and Rashida Muhammad Streets? Or can you tell me who you're expecting?
Well, I can tell you some of the people.
Okay.
Some of them could be surprised, but
okay.
Ruby Bridges will be there. She will be a keynote speaker.
Oh, nice. She's coming back. Super.
Oh, yes. And she's just such a tremendous speaker. And again, living history.
Mm-hmm.
Juliana Roosevelt will be speaking.
Oh, nice.
Ambassador Shabazz, who is Malcolm X's oldest daughter,
mm-hmm.
will be giving a speech, which I'm very touched that she's coming, because she currently, they are burying their nephew who was just assassinated.
Yeah, it's really sad.
I was on the phone with them early this morning, and she said, no, she goes, in spite of this, she goes, I really want to be there, because Malcolm X is part of Section 4.
Mm-hmm.
And she really wants to say a few words about that, which is, I'm deeply touched by that. And there are others who are coming that I won't mention the names because we're not totally positive. I will say Oscar Schindler's niece is going to be there, Rosemary Schindler.
Nice.
Which is, you know, the niece of Oscar Schindler, who is on the monument.
Mm-hmm.
And the president of the Golf Hall of Fame, representing the tribute to African Americans in golf, is going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is a great honor to have him. There'll be different politicians there. The Oakland Fire Department and the Oakland Police Department are going to be doing a special ceremony that will be very moving when we ring the bell in for the final champions.
Mm-hmm.
It's really exciting. The local champions, family relatives will all be there.
Oh, that's great.
And they'll all say a few words as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be quite a bit of media from what I understand. And,
mm-hmm.
and we're just really, really honored, proud, and excited to be doing this in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
In a place that really deserves it and needs it. And it's a place where it made me who I am. And I've been very fortunate to be part of this environment.
Wow, yeah. Well, we're happy that you're here, too.
Thank you. You're so kind.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you so much. It's been such a wonderful conversation. And I'm going to stop taping right now if I want to ask you something. So that was a wonderful conversation, wasn't it great, at length with the wonderful artist and creator of this beautiful tribute to humanitarians. And it's not exhaustive. You know, he mentioned, there are a lot more humanitarians. So this particular model, this sculpture, you know, this tribute, could actually be, created in other places, throughout the country and throughout the world. So you can look forward to that. And I am going to play one final piece from Fela, the musical, which is going to be in town, as I mentioned. I believe it was June. Let me look at my notes. Ooh, darn. June 4th through the 9th at the Paramount Theater, and they're ending their tour here in Oakland, California. Oakland is going to be the place, you know, this summer. And let's see, let me find this song. I'm trying to think which one I want to play. I was thinking about Black President, which I think is really cool. Let's see. I guess we'll play Well, darn. I don't see the one I was looking for. So, maybe I'll play something else. Equally inspirational. I love this piece that Ben Vereen sings from Wicked called Defying Gravity. And I think, you know, these great humanitarians and, you know, our heroes, who don't call themselves heroes, they're just doing the things that make them happy and, you know, giving their lives to service. You know, certainly much of what they do defies gravity. So I'm going to play this song. And thank you so much for joining us for another edition of Wanda's Picks, and looking forward to your joining us again on Wednesday, May 29th. Gosh, we're almost in June, at 6 o'clock in the morning Pacific time.
Wicked. I went into the show with Shoshana Bloom, and each night I'd hear Shoshana sing this song. I'd like to do it for you now. Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by the rules of someone else's game. Too late for second guessing. Too late to go back to sleep. It's time I trust my instincts, close my eyes, and leave. It's time to try defying gravity. I think I'll try defying gravity. And you can't hold me down. I'm through accepting limits because someone said they're so. Some things I can never change, but till I try, I'll never know. So tired of being afraid of losing love I thought I had lost. Well, if that's love, it comes at much too high a cost. I'd rather die defying gravity. Yes, I will try defying gravity, and you can't hold me down. Unlimited, my future is unlimited, and I've just had a vision, almost like a prophecy. Oh, I know this may sound crazy, and it's true, the vision is hazy, but I swear someday I'll be up in the sky defying gravity. Yes, I can fly. I'll defy gravity, and you can't hold me down. Hey! message back from me and tell them I'm defying gravity. Come take my hand. We can defy gravity. At all.